You can start just by telling me when you came here, or overall your job here.
Okay, my name is Dan Wallace, and I'm innocent until proven guilty, although that's not always been the case. But I started working here formally at the SRC in July of 78, and I had worked for PSL before that for a couple of summers with Bill Winter, making some targets that were used at Fermilab. I think they were liquid helium targets that were used for long path length, and I think that they were used for collisions with particles that came out from Fermilab. And so I had done that in the summer. And then I formally started working for the SRC in 2008. So I've been here about 31 years.
Did he work, oh, you've been working here since, is it 2008? Okay.
I'm sorry, since 1978.
Okay.
Great. I may have misspoke there the second time. Sorry.
That's all right. So did you have any involvement with Tantalus?
When one of the operators had a health problem, I went up and I actually helped. I was an operator at Tantalus for a brief period of time, and I was very familiar with the ring, how to run it, and what was going on there. The Tantalus ring was very nice, like the SRC ring, in that it is an accelerator light source that you can actually see and touch the components, and it's a very great tool for the research, but it's also wonderful for education and outreach because you can actually see the components. They're not buried in cement or behind cement walls.
That was the same thought that I had when I first came here.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to know about what I've been working on?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is going to be sort of abbreviated, but when I came, where the SRC and the trailers and everything that we consider SRC was a used farm field and also a hill that had not been used for farming because it was too rocky. And my job was to help build, to a small extent, to a larger extent, to help test and to fiducial or put references for alignment onto all of the magnets that were going to go on the storage ring. And we needed to fiducial the 12 bending magnets and the 48 quadrupole magnets and do tests on them to make sure that they were all functioning properly. And that was a major, major operation. We were looking at attempting to achieve tolerances in the area of plus or minus 1/1000th of an inch, so that the overall tolerance of putting the item into the storage ring, the survey, and the fiducialing errors was less than 4/1000th of an inch. And so we were working to very small, very tight tolerances. After the ring components were tested and analyzed and fiducialed, I was responsible for putting those items into the storage ring in the correct location using reference monuments in the storage ring. And I helped with the alignment of many other things. Once the ring was together, people attempted to make it work. After the ring was working, we had light and we started putting on beam lines. All the beam lines required alignment. Some of the new beam lines required mirrors. I assisted with the planning under the direction of Charlie Pruitt, and the planning and also the construction of many of the mirrors. We had bent mirrors that we installed that were 1 meter long. We designed them. I designed the benders, and we had them built, and they're in use today on some of the beam lines. We had some ground mirrors. I supervised the grinding of those. very delicate process. One speck of dirt and you have a scratch and you start all over again with making a good surface. And then after that we worked on installing more beam lines, aligning the beam lines, fixing problems with the beam lines. And then after that I started working more with the engineering group. Major activities there included solving the ground fault problem where the conductive hoses became filled inside with, the insulating hoses that are used for the bending magnet became filled inside with some conductive materials that allowed leakages of the current that's supposed to go to the magnetic fields. And those leakages then caused problems with beam instability, but even worse, they caused an imbalance in the power supply so that the power supply tripped off randomly, usually about once every 2 weeks. And so I used my knowledge of physics and chemistry to devise a solution there, which has worked very well. And other activities since then have been mainly working with the education and outreach group. And that's wonderful because my original training was in teaching.
What was your solution?
The solution was to analyze the, if you will, circuit that existed between the magnet power supply voltages, which in some cases would be as high as 140 volts, and the ground. And the circuit was composed of pieces like copper wires, which we normally think of as parts of circuit, but also the circuit was composed of things that we think of as insulators, which were rubber hoses. And after analyzing the circuit and looking at the basics of electrolysis, we were ripping apart various parts of the copper and doing deposition of copper inside the hoses, and you have more electrolysis and more electroplating at higher voltages. Most of that voltage was dropped across a very short, small diameter hose. And what we did is, instead of dropping that voltage across the short hoses, we extended the voltage drop out to go across the small hoses and a very large, longer hose, and that was achieved by electrically floating or insulating a water supply manifold, insulating that from ground so it could be at a higher voltage. The smaller the voltage drop across the two pieces, the less electrolysis occurred, and we had a solution. I hope what I've just described is clear.
Dave Huber had touched on that, and it was good if you got a little bit more specific information.
Yep, it was one of these things where there were very good people working in the area of physics. There were very good people working in the area of operations. We had basically fire drills every time hoses would either break or hoses would have some kind of a ground fault problem. We would have to guess where in the machine the ground fault problem was, take out the old hoses that had the coatings on the insides from running, and put in new clean hoses, and then those would later on get contaminated. And this was a major improvement just in operations, and it was also a major improvement in the business of having the power supplies properly balanced and beam stability. But the trick here was to be able to look across disciplines by looking at the physics and the electronics of what's going on to make the magnets work, but also folding in some knowledge of chemistry, and then putting that all together into a package that was acceptable. There was a fair amount of, you have to excuse the pun, a fair amount of non-electrical resistance to having any change, and people were worried that we would make a serious electrical shock hazard, and over the last probably 6 to 8 years, there have been no problems. We've insulated our pieces well, we've put precaution signs up, and we've done things correctly, and it's worked out quite nicely so far.
Great. So you were involved with Aladdin's early institutions and construction, correct?
Yep. Okay. When there was a building going up, I was down in the pit with some of the construction people, getting some reference marks established for where the center of the ring would be, and getting monuments established for later use in surveying, and watching them pour the floor, and it was all quite amazing to a young scientist who's had most of his experience basically in classrooms and then in teaching in classrooms.
Yeah. One of my questions was when Aladdin was first going, when the NSF cut off funding because they couldn't get a stable current, or they could barely get any currents. Mm-hmm. Do you have any stories or ideas you want to share about that?
I will share my knowledge. This is not necessarily going to be 100% accurate because it's been some time. Mm-hmm. But the business of controlling little tiny electrons and getting them to do what you want them to do and steering them, dealing with 12 vending magnets and 48 quadrupoles, was not a simple task. Back at that time, we did not have computers that were as functional as what we have today. Things were slower. We didn't have diagnostic tools. We did not have scripts and programs that could control these things to do easy experiments. And so we start out with a very challenging problem. To the best of my knowledge, the alignment of the ring went well, but some of the components on the ring that were sitting on the upper floor of the ring basically were wiggling small amounts because of some errors in the design of the floor. Also, some things changed because of some weight and loading changes that I was told were not important. The chief engineer, Bill Winter, did a very nice job on a lot of things, especially the heating and the air conditioning, but some of the realities of floor loading he basically did not catch, and some work had to be redone. Now, those were the smaller things that were, I think, in the background. One of the main problems is that the inflector, which is the main switching unit that takes the light that comes from the microtron and puts that light into the storage ring, the inflector had been carefully surveyed, put in position, the entrance aperture of that was exactly where it was supposed to be, and somehow the engineering group, when tightening that down or dealing with it in some way, allowed that to slip. And since it was cantilevered, gravity took control, and for I don't know how long, but longer than you would hope, we had a very good beam coming out of the microtron, but it was having just a really hard time going through a eighth-inch thick piece of copper and trying to go someplace useful because it was missing the entrance hole for, it's called the septum, for the inflector. And that was a major problem. My understanding also is that once there was some beam in the machine, there were ions that were being made, they were being trapped in various places, and the trapped ions were then acting as scattering sources and knocking the electrons out of the storage ring. Mm-hmm. So it provided a limit in the current that we could keep. Now, just to put all this in perspective, there were some simple mistakes, like allowing the septum to be in the wrong place. But other things that we were dealing with, we were at the cutting edge, and we were doing some of the early work on the business of solving the problem of ion trapping and putting in clearing electrodes. In the end, the clearing electrodes solved a lot of our difficulties, and we ended up achieving the currents that we had hoped to achieve. Once we had the ring functioning, and we actually had it that way for quite some time, we were doing experiments, and then, as most people know, more recently, we did some upgrades to get a new lattice function, and that new lattice allowed us to have a much smaller, even more compact beam. We also have better computers, better diagnostic tools, and controlling scripts so that the machine can run better.
This article I came across, I'm not sure who wrote it. We have Dave Lynch, he wrote it. He was talking about when Aladdin was running at 1.1 milliamp, likewise over at 10 milliamps. So was that the period right before all of those upgrades you just mentioned, the adjusting the septum and the clearing electrodes?
I do not know exactly what currents were where, because while this was all happening, I was actually not working on the storage ring. The accelerator guys were doing that. Mm-hmm. I cannot say exactly what was happening when. The main problem is, in my understanding, is that we had clearing and we had some alignment problems after the septum slipped. There may have been other things going on that I don't know about, but and I don't know just where in the sequence that happened.
Okay. Another question I had is
I think Walt Treziak would be able to clarify those things along with Mike Green a lot better than myself. I worked for Walt when I was doing the magnet alignment work, and he was wonderful to be working with. Very good at educating me and also keeping things going forward. Then after the ring was up and together, they didn't need my services, and I worked with Charlie Pruitt, who was also a great person to work with.
In another newsletter that I read, it was 1983, they were talking about the 21 beamlines that were being installed. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could tell me what dictated how they decided what that beamline was going to be, what kind of light it was going to be using.
Okay. Again, I'm not a planner in this area, but I have some understanding from what was going on. The first beamlines that were put on Aladdin were actually beamlines that had been used on Tantalus, and then either tested on Tantalus while the Aladdin ring was coming up, or they'd been designed and used long-term on Tantalus, and then we moved them over. They were beamlines like the, and it's fun to think back, they were beamlines like the stainless steel Saya, the Mark V Grasshopper, the Mark II Grasshopper. Those were some of the first beamlines I was involved with. John Stott and Franco Serena, to a lesser extent, were involved in the Illinois beamline that was an ERG beamline, if I remember correctly, and it, I think, was actually the first beamline to take useful data on the machine. And that would be John Stott, that would be his contribution. Then, while all of that was happening, there were some newer, fancier beamlines called 6-meter TGMs that were being designed and tested. We did a lot of work with that. There was a 4-meter TGM, 4-meter normal incident magnetometer, NIM, that was being designed, assembled, and tested. And I worked with Roger Hansen, Charlie, and Mike Green on that.
Were the developments of these new beamlines motivated by user demands, or?
Okay. No, I'm sorry, I'd forgotten the second part of your question. Each of these beamlines uses a different process. They have different resolutions, they have different throughputs, and they are designed for different energy ranges. And the choice of what was put on was partially dictated by what we already had, and in some cases it was a matter of shifting to a different grating that had a blaze in the correct place, and as opposed to a blaze optimized for tantalus. The decisions about the beamlines were made mainly by the director and the instrument group or optics group leaders, with significant input from the user community. We attempted very well to make sure the users were getting the tools that they needed for their research, and that's what these machines were.
I ask because, like you had mentioned, this is pretty cutting edge stuff, and there was no handbook or manual to decide. So it's interesting to see what forces brought on the Aladdin that's here today.
Well, there's a whole other less visible part of all this, and that would be the, if you will, the virtual contributions that occurred because Aladdin was not operating alone. There were other people at other institutions designing things, writing papers about what worked, what didn't work. We were keeping up to date very well with what we found from these papers. That helped us design some of our equipment. Our equipment was then copied and went back to other labs. So to use a biological term, there was a lot of cross-fertilization between different laboratories, especially between Brookhaven and SRC. There was also a fair amount of competition because we were sometimes vying for the same funds. So it was sort of a rather strange dance, but it appeared to work, and so far Brookhaven's still going and we're still going.
One more question. Actually, you covered those three main questions.
Good. Are there extra credit questions?
Anything that you can think of? Any interesting stories? Anything in particular that sticks in your mind?
Just some general observations. SRC has been and still is a very unique place to work, to do science. One of the really, really wonderful aspects of this laboratory is the many, many people from the United States, from Europe, from Asia, that have come to the laboratory, and they've made their contributions. We have also made our contributions by educating them in what we're doing and possibly how to do what they're doing better, and just have met some very, very wonderful people. There's a tremendous diversity of people and interest and skills on the staff here, and for the most part it's been wonderful to work with all the people here. They are for the most part very good at sharing ideas, very good at helping, and some of the people, even though are a little quirky, are just really wonderful people. Looking back, and I know that none of this is really intended to make saints out of anyone, and there probably aren't a lot of saints in our history here, but Ed Rowe was really a wonderful scientist and, I guess, leader in keeping this facility going forward. There were several times when various arguments and discussions came up, and because I am not a PhD person, basically I ended up getting stepped on, and Ed was smart enough to recognize that there was some value in what I was saying, and in some cases basically dealt with the situation very well. The situation was resolved well, and my ideas were listened to, and in a lot of cases actually used. And there's always politics anytime you have money, science, and people, and for the most part, those things got resolved reasonably well.
From what you know, can you tell me a little bit about Ed Rowe's involvement with Aladdin? I had seen the Tantalus videos, and I really can understand his role in the Tantalus years, but I don't know much about his role at the start of Aladdin.
Ed Rowe was basically the inspiration for moving this all forward, in my understanding. Ed, Charlie Pruitt, Walt Tresiak, Mike Green, they were the main accelerator people that moved things forward, and Bill Winter was the main engineer, and I think that he had been the main engineer at PSL, but something didn't work out, so he ended up being the main engineer for the SRC. And he's one of the people over time who probably did not always make positive contributions. There were some attitude issues and things there that were difficult. But he did some good, very good engineering, but he was better, to say it politely, he was much better working with the calculator and numbers than with people.
Well, that gives me plenty to go off of for now. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just that it's wonderful seeing this facility evolve. It has a lot to offer the present staff and future staff, and also the surrounding communities. And it's my hope that this laboratory continues moving forward to do whatever it can with the tools that it has to assist scientists present and the future scientists that need some educating at this point in time.
I agree.